Chapter 3, The Wager. That was a gorgeous late October in Castle Rock, with day after day of cloudless blue skies and warm temperatures. The politically progressive minority spoke of global warming. The more conservative majority called it an especially fine Indian summer that would soon be followed by a typical Maine winter. Everyone enjoyed it. Pumpkins came out on stoops. Black cats and skeletons danced in the windows of houses. Trick-or-treaters were duly warned at an elementary school assembly to stay on the sidewalks when the big night came and only take wrapped treats. The high schoolers went in costume to the annual Halloween dance in the gym, for which a local garage band, Big Top, renamed themselves Pennywise and the Clowns. In the 2 weeks or so since his dinner with Ellis, Scott continued to lose weight at a slowly accelerating pace. He was down to 180, a total drop of 60 pounds, but he continued to feel fine, tip-top, in the pink. On Halloween afternoon, he drove to the CVS drugstore in Castle Rock's new strip mall and bought more Halloween candy than he would probably need. Residents of the View didn't get a lot of costumed customers these days. There had been more before the collapse of the suicide stairs a few years earlier. But whatever the little beggars didn't take, he would eat himself. One of the benefits of his peculiar condition, aside from all the extra energy, was how he could eat as much as he wanted without turning into a podge. He supposed all the fats might be playing hell with his cholesterol, but he had an idea they weren't. He was in the best shape of his life, despite the deceptive roll hanging over his belt, and his frame of mind was better than it had been since the days when his courtship of Nora Kenner had been in full flower. In addition to all that, his department store clients were delighted with his work, convinced, fallaciously Scott was afraid, that the multiple websites he had crafted would turn their bricks-and-mortar business around. He had recently received a check for $582,674.50. Before banking it, he photographed it. He was sitting here in a little Maine town, working from his home study, and he was next door to Rich. He had seen Deirdre and Missy only twice, and from a distance, running in the park, Dee and Dumb on long leashes and not looking happy about it. When Scott got back from his drugstore errand, he started up his walk, then diverted to the elm tree in his front yard. The leaves had turned, but thanks to the warmth of that fall season, most of them were still on the tree, rustling gently. The lowest branch was 6 feet over his head, and it looked inviting. He dropped the bag with the candy in it, raised his arms, flexed his knees, and jumped. He caught the branch easily, a thing he could not have come close to doing a year ago. No wasting in his muscles, they still thought they were supporting a man who weighed 240. It made him think of old TV footage showing the astronauts who'd landed on the moon taking ginormous leaps. He dropped to the lawn, picked up the bag, and went to the porch steps. Instead of walking up them, he flexed again and jumped all the way to the stoop. It was easy. He put the candy in a bowl by the front door and went into his study. He turned on his computer but didn't open any of the work files scattered across the desktop. He opened the calendar function instead and called up the following year. The date numbers were in black except for holidays and appointments. Those were in red. Scott had marked only one appointment for next year, May 3rd. The notation, also in red, consisted of a single word, zero. When he deleted it, May 3rd turned black again. He selected March 31st and typed zero in the square. That now looked to him like the day when he would run out of weight unless the rate of loss kept speeding up, which might happen. In the meantime, however, he intended to enjoy life. Scott felt he owed it to himself. After all, how many people with a terminal condition could say they felt absolutely fine? Sometimes he thought of a saying Nora had brought home from her AA meetings. The past is history, the future's a mystery. It seemed to fit his current situation pretty well. He got his first costumed customers around 4 o'clock, and the last ones just past sunset. There were ghosts and goblins, superheroes and stormtroopers. One child was amusingly got up as a blue and white post office box, with his eyes peeking out through the slot. Scott gave most of the kids 2 of the mini-sized candy bars, but the mailbox got 3, because he was the best. The younger children were accompanied by their parents. The latecomers, a bit older, were mostly on their own. The last pair, a boy-girl combo, who were supposed to be, maybe, Hansel and Gretel, showed up at just after 6:30. Scott gave them each a couple of treats so they wouldn't trick him. Around 9 or 10, they didn't look particularly tricksy, and asked if they'd seen any others in the neighborhood. "Nope," the boy said. "I think we're the last ones." He elbowed the girl. "She kept wanting to fix her hair." "What did you get up the street?" Scott asked, pointing to the house where McComb and Donaldson lived. "Anything nice?" It had just occurred to him that Missy might have created some special Halloween treats, chocolate-dipped carrot sticks or something of that ilk. The little girl's eyes went round. "Our mother told us not to go there because those aren't nice ladies." "They're lesbians," the boy amplified. "Daddy said so." "Ah," Scott said, "lesbians. I see. You kids get home safe now. Stay on the sidewalks." They went on their way, toting their sacks of sugary treats. Scott closed his door and looked into the candy bowl. It was still half full. He thought he'd gotten 16 or maybe 18 customers. He wondered how many McComb and Donaldson had gotten. He wondered if they'd gotten any. He went into the living room, turned on the news, saw a video of kids trick-or-treating in Portland, and then turned it off again. "Not nice ladies," he thought. "Lesbians. Daddy said so." An idea came to him then, the way his coolest ideas sometimes did, almost completely formed, needing nothing but a few tweaks and a little polish. Cool ideas weren't necessarily good ideas, of course, but he intended to follow up on this one and find out. "Treat yourself," he said, and laughed. "Treat yourself before you dry up and disappear. Why not? Just why the fuck not?" Scott walked into the Castle Rock wreck at 9 the next morning with a $5 bill in his hand. Sitting at the Turkey Trot 12K sign-up table were Mike Badalamonte and Ronnie Briggs, the public works guy Scott had last seen in Patsy's. Behind them, in the gymnasium, a morning league was playing pickup basketball, shirts versus skins.
"Hey, Scotty," Ronnie said. "How you doing, my man?"
"Fine," Scott said. "You?"
"Pert," Ronnie exclaimed. "Just as pert as ever I could be. Although they cut my hours at the PW. Haven't seen you at Thursday night poker lately."
"Been working pretty hard, Ronnie. Big project."
"Well, you know what? About that thing in Patsy's." Ronnie looked embarrassed. "Man, I'm sorry about that. Trevor Yunt, he's got a big mouth, and nobody likes to shut him up when he goes off on one of his rants. Apt to get a bus nose for your trouble if you try it."
"That's all right. Water under the bridge. Hey, Mike, can I sign up for the race?"
"You bet," Mike said. "The more the merrier. You can keep me company at the back of the pack, along with the kids, the old, and the out of shape. We've even got a blind guy this year, gonna run with his service dog, he says."
Ronnie leaned over the table and patted Scott's front porch.
"And don't worry about this, Scotty, my boy. They've got EMTs at each 3K mark and 2 at the finish line. If you vapor lock, they'll kickstart you."
"Good to know." Scott paid his $5 and signed a waiver stating the town of Castle Rock would not be held responsible for any accidents or medical problems he might incur during the 7.5-mile race. Ronnie scrawled a receipt. Mike gave him a map of the race course and a number placard.
"Just pull off the backing and stick it to your shirt before the race. Give your name to one of the starters so they can check you off and you're good to go."
The number he'd been assigned, Scott saw, was 371, and this was still over 3 weeks before the big race. He whistled. "You're off to a good start, especially if these are all adult entry fees."
"They're not," Mike said, "but most are, and if this is like last year, we'll end up having 800 or 900 running. They come from all over New England, God knows why, but our piddling little turkey trot has somehow become a big deal. My kids would say it's gone viral. Scenery, Ronnie said. That's what brings them, plus the hills, especially Hunter's, and of course the winner gets to light the Christmas tree in the town square. The wreck has all the concessions along the route, Mike said. As far as I'm concerned, that's the beauty part. We're talking a lot of hot dogs, popcorn, soda, and hot chocolate. No beer, though, Ronnie said sadly. They voted it down again this year, just like the casino. And the lesbians, Scott thought. The town voted down the lesbians, too, just not at the ballot box. The town motto seems to be, if you can't keep it on the down low, then out you must go. Is Deirdre McComb still planning to run? Scott asked. Oh, you bet, Mike said. And she's got her old number, 19. We saved it for her special. Scott took Thanksgiving dinner with Bob and Myra Ellis, plus two of their 5 grown children, the ones who lived within driving distance. Scott had 2 helpings of everything, then joined the kids in a spirited game of tag in the Ellis' large backyard. He'll have a heart attack running around after all that food, Myra said.
I don't think so, Dr. Bob said. He's prepping for the big race tomorrow.
If he tries anything more than just jogging in that 12K, he will have a heart attack, Myra said, watching Scott chase down one of her laughing grandchildren. I swan, men in middle age lose all their sense. Scott went home, tired and happy, and looking forward to the turkey trot the next day. Before bed, he got on the scale and observed without much surprise that he was down to 141. He wasn't losing 2 pounds a day yet, not quite, but that would come. He turned on his computer and slid 0 day back to March 15th. He was afraid, it would have been foolish not to be, but he was also curious, and something else. Happy? Was that it? Yes. Probably crazy, but definitely yes. Certainly he felt singled out somehow. Dr. Bob might think that was crazy, but Scott thought it was sane. Why feel bad about what you couldn't change? Why not embrace it? There had been a cold snap in the middle of November, one hard enough to frost the fields and lawns, but the Friday after Thanksgiving dawned overcast and warm for the season. Charlie Lopresti on Channel 13 was forecasting rain for later, perhaps heavy, but it hadn't put a dent in Castle Rock's big day, either among the spectators or the contestants. Scott put on his old running shorts and walked up to the rec building at 7:45, over an hour before the trot was scheduled to commence. And there was already a huge crowd there, most of them wearing zip-up hoodies, which would be discarded at various points along the route as bodies warmed. The majority were waiting to check in on the left, where signs read, Out of Town Runners. On the right, where the sign read, Castle Rock Residents, there was a short single file. Scott pulled the backing from his number and pasted it on his T-shirt, above the bulge of his bogus belly. Nearby, the high school band was tuning up. Patsy Denton of Patsy's Diner checked him in and directed him toward the far side of the building, where View Drive started and the race would begin. Being local, you could cheat up to the front, Patsy said, but it's generally considered bad form. You should find the other 300s and stick with them. She eyed his midsection. Besides, you'll be running at the back with the kiddies soon enough. Ouch, Scott said. She smiled. Truth hurts, doesn't it? All those bacon burgers and cheese omelets have a way of coming back to haunt a fella. Bear it in mind if you start to feel your chest tightening up. As Scott walked over to join the growing crowd of the locals who had checked in early, he studied the little map. The course was a rough loop. Down View Drive to Route 117 was the first 3 kilometers. The Bowie Stream-covered bridge was the halfway point. Then along Route 119, which became Bannerman Road once it crossed the municipal town line. The 10th kilometer included Hunter's Hill, sometimes known as Runner's Heartbreak. It was so steep, the kids often went tobogganing there on snow days, picking up fearsome speed but kept safe by the plowed banks. The last 2 kilometers were along Castle Rock's main street, which would be lined with cheering spectators, not to mention camera crews from all 3 of the Portland TV stations. Everyone was milling in groups, talking and laughing, drinking hot coffee or cocoa. Everyone, that was, except for Deirdre McComb, looking impossibly tall and beautiful in her blue shorts and a pair of snow-white Adidas sneaks. She had placed her number, 19, off-center, high on the left side of her bright red T-shirt, in order to leave most of the shirt's front visible. On it was an empanada and Holy Free Holy, 142 Main Street. Advertising the restaurant made sense, but only if she thought it would do any good. Scott had an idea she might be beyond that now. Surely she knew that her posters had been replaced by less controversial ones. Unlike the fellow who would be running with his guide dog, Scott saw him near the starting line giving an interview, she wasn't blind. That she hadn't just said fuck it and dropped out didn't surprise him. He had a pretty good idea of why she was hanging in there. She wanted to stick it to them. Of course she does, he thought. She wants to beat them all. The men, the women, the kids, and the blind man with his German shepherd. She wants the whole town to watch a lesbian, and a married lesbian at that, throw the switch on their Christmas tree. He thought she knew the restaurant was toast, and maybe she was glad. Maybe she couldn't wait to get the hell out of the Rock. But yes, she wanted to stick it to them before she and her wife went, and leave them with that memory. She wouldn't even have to make a speech, just smile that superior smile, the one that said, "In your eye, you provincial, self-righteous assholes. Good discussion." She was limbering up, first lifting one leg behind her and holding it by the ankle, then the other. Scott stopped at the refreshment table, Frieda Racers, one to a customer, and got 2 coffees, paying $1 for the extra one. Then he walked over to Deirdre McComb. He had no designs on her, nor romantic inclinations of any kind, but he was a man and could not help admiring her figure as she stretched and turned, all the time looking raptly up at the sky, where there was nothing to be seen but slate-gray clouds. Centering herself, he thought, getting ready, maybe not for her last race, but maybe for the last one that really means something to her. "Hello," he said, "it's me again, the pest." She dropped her leg and looked at him. The smile appeared, as predictable as sunrise in the east. It was her armor. There might be someone behind it who was hurt as well as angry, but she had determined no one in the world would see that. Except, perhaps, for Missy, who was not in evidence this morning. "Why, it's Mr. Carey," she said, "and sporting a number. Also a front porch, and I do believe it's a little bigger." "Flattery will get you nowhere," he said, "and hey, maybe it's just a pillow under there, something I wear to fool people." He held out one of the cups. "Would you like a coffee?" "No. I had oatmeal and half a grapefruit at 6 this morning. That's all I'll take until halfway. Then I'll stop at one of the stands and help myself to a cranberry juice. Now, if you'll pardon me, I'd like to finish my stretches and my meditation." "Give me a minute," Scott said. "I didn't really come over to offer you a coffee because I knew you wouldn't take it. I came to offer you a wager." She had grasped her right ankle in her left hand and was starting to lift it behind her. Now she dropped it and stared at him as if he had grown a horn in the center of his forehead. "What in God's name are you talking about? And how many times do I have to tell you that I find your efforts to, I don't know, ingratiate yourself to me are unwelcome?" "There's a big difference between ingratiation and trying to be friendly, as I think you know, or would if you weren't always in such a defensive crouch."
"I'm not!"
"But I'm sure you've got your reasons to feel defensive, and let's not argue semantics. The wager I'm offering is simple. If you win today, I'll never bother you again, and that includes complaining about your dogs. Run them on View Drive all you want, and if they poop on my lawn, I'll pick it up, with never a single word of protest." She looked incredulous. "If I win? If?" He ignored this. "If, on the other hand, I win today, you and Missy have to come to my house for dinner, a vegetarian dinner. I'm not a bad cook when I put my mind to it. We'll sit down. We'll drink a little wine and we'll talk. Kind of break the ice, or at least try to. We don't have to be bosom buddies. I don't expect that. It's very hard to change a closed mind. My mind is not closed. But maybe we can be real neighbors. I could borrow a cup of sugar from you. You could borrow a stick of butter from me. That kind of thing. If neither of us win, it's a push. Things can go on the way they have. Until your restaurant closes its doors and you two blow town, he thought. Let me make sure I'm hearing this. You're betting you can beat me today? Let me be frank, Mr. Carey. Your body tells me that you're a typical overindulgent, under-exercised white American male. If you push it, you'll either go down with leg cramps, a sprained back, or a heart attack. You will not beat me today. Nobody is going to beat me today. Now please go away and let me finish getting ready. Okay, Scott said. I get it. You're afraid to take the wager. I thought you might be. She was lifting her other leg now, but she dropped it. Jesus shined up Christ on a trailer hitch. Fine. It's a bet. Now leave me alone. Smiling, Scott put out his hand. We have to shake on it. That way, if you back out, I can call you a Welsher right to your face, and you'll have to suck it up. She snorted, but gave his hand a single hard grip, and for a moment, just one small glimmer of a moment, he saw a hint of a real smile. Only a trace, but he had an idea she had a fine one when she really let it rip. Great, he said, then added, good discussion. He started away, back to the 300s. Mr. Carey, he turned back. Why is this so important to you? Is it because we are a threat to your masculinity somehow? No, it's because I'm going to die next year, he thought. And I'd like to put at least one thing right before I do. It's not going to be my marriage, that's kaput. And it's not going to be the department store websites because those guys don't understand their stores are like buggy whip factories at the start of the automobile age. But those things he wouldn't say, she wouldn't understand. How could she when he didn't fully understand himself? It just is, he said finally. He left her with that.